I was just saying that in the series of the Spinoza Institute that is devoted to temporal questions of the time, as distinguished from the research in his own philosophy, we have been always interested in questions of identity passions, tolerance, pluralism, and of course its opposite, fanaticism, political passion. And in this sense, we are discussing today the topic of religion, nationalism, and violence, which is very topical, of course. And it is quite obvious that we are not going to discuss only others in this respect, but also ourselves. The problem of the genesis of violence, horrible violence, immoral violence, out of moral beliefs in values, exasperating, exaggerated, radical, in values like religious devotion, zeal, nationalist zeal, etc. They are classically known to be the sources of violence, just as they are classically known to have been fighting each other together and against one another within the process of modernity in which we are still engaged. And in discussing these topics at a place, Jerusalem, which is saturated with those passions, historically saturated, actually saturated, with religious passions of all kinds, conflicting all the time with each other. Nationalistic passions, which are more modern, still conflicting with each other. And producing the horrors that we see on both sides, as I just said in Hebrew. The horrors committed against our civilian population and the horrors committed by those who defend our civilian population. So we are dealing at the same time with perennial problems, with problems of modernity, and with current problems of the day. I am extremely happy and pleased to welcome here for the opening address Professor Žižek, who is an internationally known intellectual, philosopher, psychoanalyst, known for his application and interpretation of, notably, the theories of Lacan, to culture, popular culture otherwise, and whose discourse very often combines the two, constant philosophical problems with topical political ones in the same discourse. Professor Žižek comes to us from Ljubljana in Slovenia. He is very often known and seen in other forums, intellectual forums around the world, including my own university in New York, the New School for Social Science, for Social Research, and others. And he has come to Jerusalem to speak for the Van Leer Foundation, for us, in the days that we know, and we appreciate very much his visit. Professor Žižek will speak, as announced, on the topic, why is September 12th more important than September 11th?
Thank you very much. I hope you don't mind being a little bit tired if I speak from here.
Just speak to the mic.
Yeah, okay. Does this work? You know what? Nonetheless, I can go there. I can do it. Okay. This one works, I hope. Let me just express the more than usual gratitude. You know, it's very simple to express gratitude at the beginning of a talk because it's already so much standardized that whatever you say, it appears a fake. So I don't know what to say. I have to deny it doubly so that it will not be the Freudian denial. I'm really glad to be here because whatever one's position it is politically vis-à-vis the conflicts here, one has to be here. Otherwise, it's hypocrisy. As to the title, it's thrust, I hope, the idea of what my title is aiming at. It should be very clear generally. What worries me is not so much the September 11th attack as such, as to how it will be and how it already is used. That is to say, how, by what political discourse it is appropriated to serve certain purposes. And here I think more than ever we should avoid false evidences and be courageous enough to think, really to think. Because one of the uses of September 11th immediately was almost literally to prevent us from thinking. You know, the first reaction in the big American media was, okay, you intellectuals, cultural studies and so on, you had your day with all these ambiguities, deconstruction, nothing is what appears to be. But sorry, we are now back into the real life where we see it. It's the enemy, it's us, the games are over. I think that such calls to immediate transparency, your games are over, now there are real life problems, such gestures, such turns to reality are usually ideology at its purest. I think that it's almost co-substantial with ideology, these gestures. Ideological games are over, now we have real problems. And I think that we, above all, have to gather the courage to render problematic the very fundamental terms, coordinates, within which the media, or to use the old-fashioned terms, more than media, the hegemonic ruling ideology, is presenting to us the predicament in which we are. Usually it is said it is the conflict between open democratic societies and fundamentalists. The first problem that I had with the term fundamentalism is, my God, who is today really a fundamentalist? I mean, those whom I know and who really are fundamentalists are, I would say, rather good guys. There should be more fundamentalists. For example, if you say fundamentalism, I immediately have two associations. One would be the Amish in the United States. And be sure my source is not only Peter Weir's film with Harrison Ford, Witness. I did read a book about them. And you know why they are true fundamentalists? Because what they display and what this fake moral majority fundamentalists don't display is a total Amish, display a total lack of envy towards the outsiders. I think that a true fundamentalist has his, their, her way and simply trusts it, which is why there is none of this envious obsession with some secrets of the other. My God, what sinful things are going on there, abortions, homosexuality or what. You don't have this envious hatred towards the other. You are what you are, which is why your relations with others are usually very tolerant. Amish people don't have any problems with Englishmen around them. I'm not idealizing them. I know they have their own number of family rapes and so on and so on. But what I'm saying is that they lack this envy, which is, for me, the trademark, this envy of others' enjoyment, the trademark of this false moral majority fundamentalism. You know, all the time this obsession about some terrible excessive enjoyment, what the homosexuals are doing, what depravity there is today. And also here in Jerusalem itself, as I was told, that there are these truly Orthodox Jews who are not to be confused with aggressive nationalism or whatever. So, again, my point would be that what we call fundamentalism is usually, I think, something which, as to its content, refers to fundamentalism, but its form already betrays itself. So when you mention to me somebody like of these American televangelist figures, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and so on, I think we give them, concede to them way too much dignity to even call them fundamentalists. I think that the very way, this would be a Hegelian point, the very way they present their message through TV shows, all these publicity campaigns, undermines their message. They pretend to be fundamentalists, but effectively they present fundamentalism as the new, more effective ego trip, and so on. They are, for me, worse individualists than so-called liberal individualists are, as to the form of their activity. So again, we have to have the courage to problematize even the most fundamental, elementary notions, coordinates proposed to us by the media. For example, let me go directly to the point now. recall the commonplace, popular, especially in our intellectual circles, the commonplace notion that the aggressive monotheism, Jewish, Islamic, or Christian, is at the roots of our predicament. You know, the idea that monotheism oppresses the plurality, it involves some kind of oppressive totalization, exclusion of all others, and so on and so on. Well, I don't think things are as simple as that. What I'm tempted to claim, being, although I'm privately and personally, sorry, an atheist, but being nonetheless in my, call it, attitude, much closer to monotheism, I claim that whenever the so-called monotheism engages in exclusive violence against others, it's rather a proof that it's secretly still polytheistic. What do I mean by this? The fanatic hatred of the believers, the fanatic hatred of the monotheists, hatred directed against the believers in a different God, I think it bears witness to the fact that the monotheist who engages in this hatred secretly thinks that he is not fighting simple false believers, but that his struggle is a struggle between different gods, the struggle of his God against false gods, who nonetheless are false gods, but exist as gods. Such a monotheism is effectively exclusive, in the sense that it has to exclude other gods. For that reason, true monotheists are tolerant. For them, others are not objects of hatred, but simply people who should be nonetheless respected, since they are not inherently evil, they just don't know the truth, and so on, and so on. So you got my point. I think that the only way to account for this apparently monotheistic hatred of the other is to accept the fact that secretly they think that they are not just attacking people who do not believe, but that secretly they believe that their struggle is metaphysical, to put it in these terms. That it's a struggle of metaphysical forces, which is, again, polytheistic. Consequently, next step. Our next target should be the ideology which is usually proposed as a solution, as the way out of this so-called monotheistic violence. For example, the so-called Oriental spirituality, Buddhism, Taoism, whatever, Oriental wisdom, with, so they say, its more gentle, balanced, holistic, ecological, whatever approach. You know all the stories about how, say, when digging up earth for the foundations of a house, Tibetan Buddhists are careful not to kill any worms, and so on and so on. Display, no. Then you can put to this a feminist twist, an ecological twist. The point is that we in the West are, and I could go on almost indefinitely, bad, Cartesian, imperialistic, monotheist, we dominate nature, masculine, phallic, phallocentric, and so on, against the East, which is holistic, dialogue with nature, and so on, all the good things. Now, I'm opposed, radically opposed to this ideology. For reasons which I don't have time to develop here, I think that this ideology is, under the guise of what I ironically call Western Buddhism, as the new version of Western Marxism, no, which is today predominant, that this pop cultural phenomenon is maybe, as to its structure, even if it's not empirically, the predominant ideology of today. Of today's, let's call it in traditional terms, late capitalism. The fundamental premise here is what? Is preaching inner distance and indifference towards the frantic pace of market competition. That's the lesson. And this lesson is very interesting because I think that it's closely connected to the fact that what happened in the last decades is that we are back to the notion of faith. No? Somewhere till the 60s, the idea was still, this is what they all shared together, communism, they shared together, communism and Western liberal social democracy, the idea was still that somehow a collective subject, a society, maybe even humanity, can steer its development. Now we abandoned it. The idea is that any attempt to collectively influence social development is immediately denounced as totalitarian and so on. And here I think, of course, the greatest chances has the ideology which says don't even try to get what Frederick Jameson calls cognitive mapping, just withdraw, world is a false spectacle, withdraw, find inner wisdom, But you know what's the paradox here? The paradox is the following one, that it's very indicative to read how they usually are structured. This, for example, publicity posters for courses on transcendental meditation and so on and so on. There is usually the first larger paragraph where the message is, don't you see how material life is vanity, it's not worth, withdraw into yourself, discover the truth in yourself, find the simplicity of life. But then, I'm sorry, but this is my experience, there always follows a smaller second paragraph which basically says, in this way you will be even more successful on the market. No? And I think that's it. In what sense? Let me specify it a little bit. So, again, my thesis is, as I put it in my book on belief, my thesis is that if Max Weber, were to be alive today, he would definitely wrote a volume no longer Protestantism and the Ethic, but Western Buddhism or Taoism and the Ethics of Global Capitalism. That's what we have today. Why? If you ask people, where are we today? Where do we stand? Of course, the answer you will get is post-ideological era, nobody believes, nobody takes it seriously, we are cynical, and only fundamentalists take it seriously. And I think this is effectively our shock, why we are so shattered when we encounter a so-called fundamentalist, because we are so used not taking things seriously that, you know, there is somebody who, at least it appears, that he really believes. And it's a very complex question. I don't have time to elaborate it now. A very complex question, do they really believe? I will not go to it now. We can go later into it in discussion. I think the answer is no. I think that, if anything, we believe more than ever. Okay, but my point is that's our superficial attitude. We don't believe it. We are cynical. But there is a but. What is this but? I think that today, the predominant functioning of ideology at the level of our everyday lives is no longer what I would call, referring to Louis Althusser, the symptomal functioning, but rather what I call the fetishist functioning. In what does it reside, the difference between symptom and fetish? To put it very simply, I simplify here things to the utmost, symptom is the return of the repressed truth in the midst of global lie. Like, you repress something, and nonetheless, what you repress, it returns. Like, to put an extremely vulgar common example, you know, the proverbial example of an adolescent who is frustrated by sexuality, tries to repress it, then escapes into abstract mathematics, but then whatever he does there, it reminds him of this. Like, all of a sudden there is a mathematical task, how much energy is released when two bodies hit each other, and so on. You know, you cannot escape it. But fetish is something very interesting. Fetish is, for me, one approach is to it, a particular lie. It's not the repressed of a truth within the global field of lie, of falsity, but it's a particular lie which enables you to sustain the global truth, or at least, in the more common sense, reality the way it is. What do I mean by this? Let me give you a simple example, first from private pathology. It's a personal example which affected me personally because it happened to a good friend of mine. You know this usual story. He was happily married, young, beautiful wife. The wife went to a doctor once and got the usual message. In 3 months, you're dead, breast cancer. No, okay. So after the wife died, what could have been the reaction of the friend of mine? The standard reaction would have been repression. You avoid the topic after the wife's death, you try not to talk about it. But then, you know, again, the repressed returns. Whatever you do, something will always remind you of the beloved, horrible death. We, by we I mean the friends of this friend of mine, we were deeply shocked that this was not his reaction. It was possible to talk to him all the time openly. And he was even eager to explain, to tell to us the most painful moments, last hours of the wife's life and so on and so on. So we thought, my God, what's going on here? Is he some kind of a pervert? Or, I mean, what's going on? How can he be so cold, so insensitive? Then we got the answer. The answer was that whenever he was talking about his deceased wife, it's so tragicomic that if it were not true, it would sound, and it still does sound improbable, he always held in his hands a small hamster. Hamster was his wife's preferred pet object. And the idea was, of course, it's elementary, that through this hamster was a fetishist denial of the wife's death. It's, you know, as we put it in more traditional terms, he, this friend of mine, he rationally accepted the wife's death, but he, emotionally in his psychic structure, he behaved through this clinging to this fetish object, he behaved as if the wife is not yet dead. And now you will say, but isn't this the most vulgar wild pop psychology? How do I know it is true? Unfortunately, I do, because half a year later, the hamster died, and this friend of mine had immediately to be hospitalized. He tried serially he tried suicides and so on. So you got the point. It's, you don't repress the traumatic news. You totally accept it, because you have a small lie, the denial. You have the, in this case, the fetish, the hamster to cling to. And what's my idea? How do we transpose these to social relations? Well, to cut a long story short, my idea is that along the same lines, we are today officially cynical, unbelievers, and so on. Large ideological stories are out, whatever you want. But we each have our hamsters, no? And so whenever somebody tells you, listen, don't give me that crap, who believes today in ideology, I am ready to accept life the way it is, the big critical counter-offensive should start with the question, okay, but where is your hamster? And I claim that what I called Western Buddhism is one big fat hamster today. That is to say, you think you have this inner distance, but basically it's the other way around. This Eastern spirituality is here just to enable you to function all the better. Let me go further now. You would say, okay, but this is our Western misuse of it. What about the real, original, Oriental, authentic Oriental version? Here, I think things get even more complicated. My source is here a wonderful book by a guy called Brian Victoria, who himself is a Zen Buddhist monk, Zen at War, published in New York in 1998, where he asked himself a simple question. How did the Buddhist hierarchy in Japan relate to the Japanese war efforts in the 30s and 40s? And the discovery is pretty shattering. With some exceptions, literally 6-7 people, they all fully supported it. Inclusive, if you are old enough to remember from the 60s, in hippie era, Daisetsu Taitaro Suzuki, the great guru. That was in the 60s. In the 30s and 40s, he wrote eulogies of Japanese invasion of China, and so on and so on.